Welcome everybody to the Sutta class for this week. This week the Dhamma Dayada Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya number 3, being the third Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya. Alright, and it discourse on the heirs in the Dhamma, consisting of a brief instruction by the Buddha followed by an explanation by Sariputta. This discourse has two Chinese parallels found in the Majjhima Agama and in the Ekotara Agama. So the Majjhima Agama version, Majjhima Agama 88, the Pali and the Ekotara version are both situated in the Jeta's Grove at Savatthi, while the Majjhima Agama version of the Sarvasivadin school locates the discourse near the village Panchasala in the same district of Kosala. This cannot be the same, according to Venerable Nalaya's comments, this cannot be the village Panchasala. Panchasala means the five halls. Cannot be the five-hall village mentioned in another discourse in the Pali Sanyutta, since this village was situated in the district of Magadha. So perhaps two villages called Panchasala, or perhaps there's simply been some confusion there. So we recall in mind the Savatthi redaction normalization principle we learnt about previously, which means, in essence, that if you don't know where it was, you say it was at Savatthi. Okay, very good. So, as a rule, we assume that if there are two locations for a discourse given and one of them is Savatthi, that it's more likely to actually be the other place. But that's just a working hypothesis. Okay, it's a working hypothesis for which we develop a fancy and convoluted name just to make ourselves sound sophisticated, whereas in fact it's very simple. Right, okay. So the Pali and the two Chinese discourses in this case are quite similar. Notice again, just to bear in mind, one of the Chinese is found in the Sarvasivadin Majjhima, the other one found in the Ekotara, probably belonging or possibly belonging to the Mahasanghika school, although it's not really known. But notice that how it's organized differently. The same sutta might be in a Majjhima in one school, and maybe in Ekotara or Sangyukta or something of another school. Okay, so this one, very direct and practical discourse, in contrast with the very philosophical discourse of the Mulaparyaya Sutta.
Sante, I know that you wrote a book about it, which I haven't completed
yet, so I haven't got to the place where you say that it were different schools. Mm-hmm.
You just quoted one. What is that school?
I just mentioned the Sarvasivadins,
yeah,
and the Mahasanghikas.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
those two? What are they?
Yeah.
Okay. The first schism in Buddhism, according to just about all the sources that we have, was between a group called the Elders, Staviras, and a group called the Mahasanghikas. And so these kind of two groups of schools are regarded as the oldest, first originating schools in Buddhism. So that group, the essential difference, it's not really clear what the essential difference was. From the Pali school says that the difference was textual redaction, and that they didn't like the way the Mahasanghikas revised their texts. Mahasanghikas themselves also agree that it was textual redaction, but they don't like the way that the elders revised their texts, right? And the Sarvasivadins and other schools say that the real cause of the schism was the propounding of the so-called five theses of Mahadeva, or five theses, which is sometimes attributed to Mahadeva. And the basic gist of those theses was, it seems, to criticize or downgrade the Arahant. Okay. So, or at least some kinds of Arahants. Okay. So, it's often held that Mahasanghika was, in that sense, was a precursor to the Mahayana, for whom that was a much more developed theme.
That they downgraded
the Arahant.
The Mahayana?
Yeah.
No,
that the Mahasanghika did, and that was a precursor to the Mahayanas, which downgraded the Arahant, yeah.
Could you explain how that, because I, what that meant, because it seems so crucial, and I, one, that this is way off the topic, and you know,
Yeah, we should. It is a little bit off the topic, but we can talk about it a little bit. I mean, there's just a tendency. See, I think there's a tendency, like when you see in the early suttas, you know, obviously the Arahant is very praised and all of these kinds of things, but also you do see a few places where Arahants are criticized. They do something wrong. And that's not infrequent at all in the suttas. And so it's quite acknowledged that the Arahants can do things wrong. But, you know, of course, you usually believe that that's not regarding fundamental things of the Dhamma, but just regarding, you know, more kind of minor details of, you know, what's the right course of action to do here, you know. And so that's a theme in the early suttas. So, and of course, there's always a tendency, we're talking about spiritual attainments, to want to kind of bring them down over time, yeah, because people want to, they want to be there, or they want their teacher to be there, yeah, or they want to assume that people that they know actually have those attainments, and so will tend to explain away problems and defilements and so on that their teacher may have. So this is a very common tendency which you can observe in different spiritual traditions, when you have a teacher who, you know, in some cases, quite manifestly has problems, that the students will be very concerned to try to explain these away and excuse the teacher. And so it seems, you know, very likely that this kind of tendency was at work. And so there was, you know, some things like, can an Arahant have doubt? Okay, so it would seem very ordinary that if you say, well, an Arahant, you ask an Arahant, do you know the way to Mosvale? Well, maybe they know the way to Mosvale, maybe they don't. And so they might have doubt about that. They might have to ask somebody, what's the way to Mosvale? That's not intrinsic to what we think about as Arahantship. But they shouldn't necessarily have doubt about the path and the practice and so on. But even then, you know, we read some time ago the Buddhist discourse to Rahula, where Sariputta gave meditation instructions to Rahula, which seemed to have been not quite to the point. His meditation instructions were perhaps not as good as the Buddha's would have been, even though they weren't bad instructions, but they weren't 100% appropriate for that particular case. And so this also, that's getting a bit more borderline. You know, so getting, well, is that, you know, where you can understand where he could be making mistakes in regard to Dhamma practice as well. And so these are some of the issues that were going on. No doubt also there were personal conflicts involved. Yeah. And so anyway, there was this split between these two groups, and most scholars have concluded that that split happened before the time of Ashoka, but that was one of the themes of sects and sectarianism, that I argue that the split, there's no good evidence to show that any kind of such split happened until maybe a century or so after Ashoka. Okay, so that's the Mahasanghikas. The Sarvastivadins were a later one of the schismatic groups. When we talk about the early schools, there were 18 or more early schools, but actually only about 4 or 5 significant groups of schools, each of which may have had several sub-schools which were not of huge, not hugely different from one another, but maybe just local variations. So the Sarvastivadins, their intrinsic doctrine was that everything in the past, present and future exists.
In this moment.
Well, that's a matter of interpretation, isn't it? Yeah. So their doctrine was that the past, present, all dhammas in the past, present and the future exist.
Simultaneously.
Mm.
Or exist.
Exist. And then the philosophers get to work. And then they try to explain what that could possibly mean, okay, and try to interpret it and give similes for it and philosophical justifications and work out the implications of it. But that was their essential thesis. And that thesis itself derives from sutta passages where the Buddha says this Dhamma, for example, dependent origination or Four Noble Truths, applies in the past, it applies in the present, just as it applies in the future, just as it applies in the present, yeah. And so the Dhamma with a capital D, if you like the principle or the natural law, applies in the past, present and future. So they then interpreted that to mean that Dhammas, that all things, all phenomena, also exist in the three periods of time. And one of the main sort of emotional motivations for that development was the sense of loss at the passing away of the Buddha, and the sense of wanting to try and make the Buddha real in the present moment, trying to resurrect the Buddha, bring him back to life, yeah? Because he's passed away, so he's in the past, yeah? So how do you make him present? Yeah. And so this was one of the those very important movements. So the Sarvastivadins represent one of the major schools originally and eventually groups of schools, which was especially prominent in the northwestern region, Mathura and Kashmir. So of the existing agamas, the Madhyama Agama belonged to the Sarvastivada school or one of their sub-schools, and the Ekotra Agama, equivalent to the Anguttara, is very hard to say who it belongs to, but most scholars have tended to suggest that it belongs to Mahasanghika or one of their branch, one of their sub-schools. It's a very, very problematic text though. Okay. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living in Savatthi in Jeta's Grove in Natabindika's park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. I'm just correcting the text from the obvious editorial with blunders here. Bhante, they replied, the Blessed One said this, bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, be my heirs in dhamma, not my heirs in material things. Okay, so this is the basic theme of the sutta, to be heirs in the Dhamma. So, of course, this is always a very controversial thing, isn't it? Who's going to inherit? Yeah, if whenever you have any property or anything like this, is one of the structures that we build our societies on, is the inheritance laws. For example, you have in India, you have the inheritance laws where all of the property and land gets divided up among the children, which is fine, but then you have these bits of land which get divided into smaller and smaller bits. And so you end up with having a katta, which is not much bigger than this room, and somebody's expected to inherit this and do their farming on it and raise their cow and grow their vegetables on it. And so that's one kind of inheritance law. In Bhutan, they have much more sensible inheritance laws. It all goes to the daughter. So she inherits everything. And the men all complain that they're discriminated against. So when talking about this dyada, the kind of the implication, you know, starting to be an implication of passing down the Dhamma, so that, like, you're not just talking about the Buddha and what the Buddha's saying and so on, but who's actually inheriting this. So you're starting to look at, it's this kind of slightly future orientated sutta. The Buddha's sort of looking at how is this Dhamma going to be going to manifest, going to pass down in the future. What's actually going to happen to it as the bhikkhus go on? And so it's compared with the other suttas we've been looking at, it's slightly turning towards the future, looking at what's going to happen to Buddhism, what's going to happen to the Dhamma after I'm around. Bhikkhus, be my heirs in the Dhamma, not my heirs in material things. So Dhamma, as we know, having very many meanings here. Bhikkhu Bodhi in his translation has conventionally given it a capital D, meaning the teaching. The doctrine that's taught by the Buddha. And not my heirs in material things. And the word for material things here is amisa, which literally means raw things. Okay? And sort of raw and slightly smelly things like raw, rotting meat and these kinds of things. So amisa has this connotation of things being worldly and fleshy.
Is it that it's inherently negative, this word here for material thing?
Amisa, in this kind of context it is, yeah. Yeah. Sometimes it's in like the you also have like amisa and niramisa, which we translate as like spiritual and worldly. Or carnal. Carnal is not a bad translation of amisa. Out of compassion for you, I have thought, how shall my disciples be my heirs in Dhamma, not my heirs in material things? If you're my heirs in material things, not my heirs in Dhamma, you will be reproached thus. The teacher's disciples live as his heirs in material things, not as his heirs in the Dhamma. And I will be reproached thus. The teacher's disciples live as heirs in material things, not as his heirs in Dhamma. So here introducing the theme of praise and blame. And so to be able to live one's life in a way that's beyond reproach, this is one form of suffering, as we all know, that to be blamed and criticized for things is very stressful, very distressing to have people come up and criticize us. We feel very bad. if people say to us as monks and nuns that we're, or as followers of the Buddha, that you know we're supposed to be monks and nuns, we're supposed to be Buddhists, and we're not really practicing as the Buddha taught us, and that makes us feel very sad, upset, makes us feel very ashamed, as it should do. And so this to escape this kind of suffering, of this kind of shame, is why the Buddha's taught this sutta out of compassion. So the Buddha goes on to then give the positive side of this. If you are my heirs in Dhamma, not my heirs in material things, you will not be reproached. It will be said, the teacher's disciples live as his heirs in Dhamma, not as his heirs in material things. And I will not be reproached. As it will be said, the teacher's disciples live as his heirs in Dhamma, not as his heirs in material things. Therefore, because be my heirs in Dhamma, not my heirs in material things, out of compassion for you, I have thought, how shall my disciples be heirs in Dhamma, not my heirs in material things? And, you know, always to remember this, that the Buddha is giving these teachings, as we'll see a bit later on. This particular teaching he's going to give us is quite stirring, quite difficult to live up to, yeah? But we shouldn't think that the Buddha's being cruel to us because he's insisting that we do these things. In fact, he's doing it out of compassion. Now, because suppose that I had eaten, refused more food, had my fill, finished, had enough, had what I'd needed, and then some alms food was left over to be thrown away. Then two bhikkhus arrived hungry and weak. So this was an issue in that time about the monks who had eaten and finished their food according to the system at which the food was distributed and eaten and so on. There's actually a couple of vinaya rules which are laid down to deal with this situation, and that makes it, there's actually a formal vinaya procedure to leave over the extra food. And I think when it says, you know, like refused, finished, had enough, it's not 100% sure what it's referring to here, but maybe that what it's referring to is the kind of way of offering dana that they do still in Sri Lanka. It's very common today where the people will actually come around as you're eating, like a second and a third time with the food, and sort of offer, you know, do you want any more curry, do you want any more rice, and want to put more food in your bowl. And so, you know, you kind of refuse that and you say, no, I've finished everything, I've had enough. And you're refusing food. Then two bhikkhus who arrived who are hungry and weak. And I told them, bhikkhus, I have eaten. I've had enough. I've had what I needed. But there is this armsuit of mine left over to be thrown away. Eat it if you like. If you do not eat it, then I shall throw it away where there is no greenery, or drop it into water where there is no life. So this is the Buddha's concern for not polluting. Very ideologically sound. He didn't want to mess up the ground and the clean water. So he would dispose of something in an appropriate way. And one of the bhikkhu thought, the Blessed One has eaten. Okay, but there is this alms food. If we don't eat it, the Blessed One will throw it away. But this has been said by the Blessed One, bhikkhus, be my heirs in Dhamma, not my heirs in material things. Now this alms food is one of the material things. Suppose that instead of eating this alms food, I pass the night and day hungry and weak. Instead of eating that alms food, he passed that night and day hungry and weak. Right? So it's the first monk. He reflects on this saying. So notice how you've got this like little catchphrase, you know, be my heirs in Dhamma, not my heirs in material things. It was kind of memorized because you remember it. And it's ready when you need it. Yeah, this is the important thing, that if you memorize it, you know it very well. Then when the time comes up, oh, okay, you have it in your mind, you remember it. So he says, I'm not going to eat. And even the whole night and whole day, he's very hungry and weak. And then the second bhikkhu thought, the Blessed One has eaten. He's had what is needed, but there is this alms food of the Blessed One left over to be thrown away. Suppose that I eat this alms food and pass the night and day, neither hungry nor weak. After eating that alms food, he passed the night and day, neither hungry nor weak. So, which one is better? Of course you don't know because you cheated, didn't you? You read
the word of the Pali translation into weak, like it said.
I just wondered about that. Like, physically weak, like no energy to practice. Yeah.
So no energy to practice, physically weak.
Yeah. The Pali word there is gigacha dubalyena. Gigacha is like hungry. Dubalya, literally weak, of little energy. usually, yeah, physically weak. So, and of course the bhikkhu says, although that bhikkhu by eating that alms food passed the day, night and day, neither hungry nor weak, yet the first bhikkhu is more to be respected and commended by me. Why is that? Because that will long conduce to his fewness of wishes, contentment, effacement, easy support and arousal of energy. Therefore, bhikkhus, be my heirs in Dhamma, not my heirs in material things. Out of compassion for you, I have thought, how shall my Dhammas be heirs, how shall my disciples be heirs in the Dhamma and not heirs in material things? So here is the very kind of quite striking and quite memorable comparison by the Buddha that even if you don't eat and you're weak for all the night and day and you can't really meditate properly because you're too weak, but still you're better off refusing the food. Is that right?
Can't be, because he says that you're able to arouse energy, so you can't be so weak that you can't arouse energy in your meditation.
But maybe that might be later that you can arouse energy in your meditation. Yeah? Because you're still going to be able to eat the next day. For a long time conducive doesn't mean at that time it's conducive, yeah? But it, what also that's also an important point, because you've made the karma, yeah, of practicing, because what you've actually done is you practice that right effort of renunciation, yeah, to let go of that thing, and it's that right effort of renunciation which allows you to actually generate energy in the future. Yeah. But did the Buddha want us to go around hungry and weak? Is this the action of a compassionate teacher?
Well, one day is good, and obviously 20 days are better.
One day is good, then 20 days is better. So how long does it go on for, yeah?
Right.
So if we just keep on refusing.
Thinking on that it's okay to go to an extreme.
You could do, yeah. James?
I don't see any necessity, but by abstaining, the bhikkhu would be weak at all. I don't see that that's a necessity that follows. Maybe hungry, but not necessity.
Sure, yeah, practically speaking, I agree. Yeah, there's not you know, leaving, just not going without food for a day doesn't necessarily leave you weak. Yeah.
That's in the mind of the bhikkhu, it's taking that particular course of action with that set of thoughts.
Maybe.
I would be weak if I didn't eat. At all for one whole day.
It seems they arrive weak, doesn't it, in the beginning, to say that
they were hungry and weak already. Maybe they're hungry and weak already, yeah. Yes. So I don't know, but people
are
people
bastard. I have never been weak.
People are very, very different. Yeah, with that. Some people can fast for many days and not have a particular problem. Other people. Last time I tried to fast, I got very sick, very quickly. So, it could be very, very different for different people. But I think the point is still there. It's a very challenging one. And because normally we would think that the middle way says, okay, have enough to eat so that your body is comfortable, and you can meditate. Yeah, and here the Buddha is sort of pushing the envelope a bit. Maybe the reason he's giving this challenging teaching, as it says in the commentary to the sutta, says that the many bhikkhus were becoming elated over the gains and honour accruing to the Sangha to the neglect of their spiritual training. The Buddha obviously could not lay down a training rule prohibiting the use of requisites, but he wanted to show the practice of the heirs in Dhamma to those bhikkhus who were earnestly desirous of training. So remember I said before that this sutta has some kind of future orientation, and it reminds us of a number of suttas where the Buddha warns us of the dangers of the future. And indeed, as we go along, we'll see some of the very same phrases that are used here are also used in those other suttas, talking about the dangers of what can happen in the future. They're mentioning if this was at a time when there was many gains and so on accruing to the Sangha, then perhaps it may well be towards the latter part of the Buddha's life when he'd become very famous, very well known. The Sangha's starting to get wealthy and so on. And that the monks were starting to get sloppy and lazy. Not at all implausible. And so that's why it's a slightly stirring, slightly strong teaching. All right. So this is what the Blessed One said. Having said this, the Sublime One rose from his seat and went into his dwelling. Soon after he left, the Venerable Sariputta addressed the bhikkhus thus. Friends, bhikkhus. Friend, they replied. The Venerable Sariputta said this. So notice that Sariputta and the monks refer to each other as friend, abhuso, and they don't use any other kind of exalted honorific. In these days, of course, if you had to refer to a monk as respected as Venerable Sariputta, then you'd have to say most respected guru and lord of the nation and bearer of the Tripitaka in the Maha Sri Sri Venerable Most Reverend High something something something. But here they are a bit more simple about these things. Okay, so here's some interesting difference. The up until here, the different versions, the Pali version and the two Chinese versions, are much the same. However, there's an interesting difference here, because in this case, Venerable Sariputta is bringing up a new teaching. So the next paragraph, Venerable Sariputta asks, friends, in what way do teachers of the disciple who lives secluded not train in seclusion? And in what way do disciples of the teacher who lives secluded train in seclusion? So here, Venerable Sariputta is bringing up a new teaching, which is quite different from the previous teaching about being an heir in the Dhamma. But according to the Madhyama Agama version, the Buddha, after giving the first part of the discourse, the Buddha next spoke of a teacher who practiced seclusion but whose disciples did not follow their teacher's example. Such a situation, he pointed out, was to the detriment of many beings. Having said that much, the Buddha indicated to Sariputta that he had a sore back and requested that Sariputta continue instructing the bhikkhus. So this was the Madhyama Agama version. And again, just as a little side point, we notice that the Buddha, saying he has a sore back, also suggestive of it being quite a late discourse, probably towards the end of the Buddha's life. And this is starting to be a concern for him. And, the Buddha used to do this quite often. He used to say, I've got a bit of a sore back, I'm going to have a lie down. So often, in fact, that even Devadatta, when he took off the 500 monks, and tried to convert them to his own following, also did the same thing, and he sort of, trying to copy the Buddha, he sort of said, oh, I've got a sore back and I'll lie down, but he fell asleep and started snoring. So he didn't quite do it the same. James?
Is there any indication in this text so far to suggest what time of day?
No, it doesn't give any indication what time of day it might be. Yeah.
So it's not an issue of, say, eating before midday.
No, I don't think it's got anything to do with the eating before midday idea. Yeah. Not as far as I know.
The other thing is, from an English language point of view, mm-hmm. heirs are recipients of something after the deceasement of some other person.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a situation like that, is it? No one's died. The Buddha hasn't at this stage passed away. And
how would you put it? If you were, what other word would you use if you weren't to use heir?
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, true that an heir is used of someone who receives something after someone dies. But I think that the word dayada, the Pali word there, also has that implication that it's, what you receive after somebody dies. So, he could have consciously been using that kind of thing, and again perhaps suggestive of the fact that he's maybe approaching near the end of his life. So here we have this little difference, whereas the Pali version and the Ekottara version just have the Buddha going off and then Sariputta starting out on a new topic, whereas in the Madhyama Agama version the Buddha introduces the new topic first and then goes off, and then Sariputta continues to explain that, which certainly is a more fluent or more coherent way of framing the narrative. And that same Madhyama Agama version, before Sariputta starts to talk about living in seclusion, he asks the monks, what do they understand? How do they understand what the Buddha said on living in seclusion? And in reply, two monks expressed their opinion, describing the delight experienced by other monks when a senior monk declared that he has gained awakening, or when witnessing a monk of middle standing or new monk intent upon gaining awakening. But Sariputta was not entirely satisfied with these replies. Okay, so this was the reply perhaps given not entirely to the point. Okay, so here again we have this idea of the teacher and the disciple, and that the importance that the disciple should be following in the way of the teacher, and of course that means that the teacher should be setting a good example for the disciples to follow. So after Sariputta has introduced the topic, the monks then reply, "Indeed, friend, we would come from far away to learn what from Venerable Sariputta the meaning of this statement. It would be good if the Venerable Sariputta would explain the meaning of this statement. Having heard it from him, the bhikkhus will remember it. Then, friends, listen and attend closely to what I shall say." "Yes, friend," the bhikkhus replied, "the Venerable Sariputta said this." So again, just notice that move. We started talking about the Dhamma Dayada, the heirs in the Dhamma, and now it's moved, the narrative's now moved from the Buddha. The Buddha's now left the stage, and Sariputta's taken over the stage. So it's now the heir, it's the student, who's now the one who's actually speaking, yeah? And so presumably Sariputta, by filling this role, is regarded as someone who himself is a Dhamma Dayada, who has received, inherited the Dhamma from the Buddha, and is capable of acting in the Buddha's stead, and of sustaining the sasana in the absence of the Buddha.
And isn't it easier that Mahakasapa brings to that situation? And also, Sariputta's going to be God before the Buddha, so it must be just before he died, or...
Yeah, so, Sariputta died very, very shortly before the Buddha, so, yeah, sometime in that period, likely. And yes, you're quite right that Venerable Mahakasapa is often in this kind of role, and has this great concern for sustaining the sasana and for the correct and strict and rigorous conduct of the bhikkhus was a special concern of Mahakasapa.
I've also noticed this tendency within the suttas to put down Sariputta because there's the one in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta who states about the Buddha is the best Buddha,
mm-hmm.
and he says you don't know directly
their
mind is your mind. And then there's the other case where he's instructing a lay disciple before he passes away to be with the Brahma world.
The Dhammajani Sutta, yeah.
Yeah, then the Buddha criticized him for that. That was not the highest goal you could have fought him.
That's right. And also in the beginning the Virandakanda in the Vinaya, where he asks the Buddha to lay down the Vinaya rules and the Buddha refuses.
So although he's foremost in wisdom, it seems that...
He gets told off by the Buddha fairly frequently, yeah? Which is quite nice, isn't it? It's quite sweet. But again, I think that's acting as a precursor. I think this is where the Mahayana Sutras were using that precedent, you know? But when the Mahayana Sutras use it, it's more like a literary precedent. It sets up a drama, it sets up a tension within the narrative, you know, that you have this kind of great disciple, and then you say, "No, do not say so, Sariputta," you know. And then you think, "Oh," you know, so it's where it actually creates interest within the narrative structure. Yeah. But I mean, it gets a bit kind of overused, it becomes a bit of a cliché in the Mahayana Sutras. The sāvakas always being told off and told how they have little wisdom and these kinds of things. Okay. "Friends, in what way do disciples of the teacher who lives secluded not train in seclusion?" Here, disciples of the teacher who lives secluded do not train in seclusion. They do not abandon what the teacher tells them to abandon. They are luxurious and careless, leaders in backsliding and neglectful of seclusion. So these kinds of phrases, you know, the luxurious and careless leaders in backsliding, neglectful of seclusion, these are also found, the same phrases are also found in the Anagata Bhayani Sutras, the sutras on the dangers in the future, which were recommended by King Ashoka for the monks to study. So again, that context of like, what is that fear, what's the actual danger of what's going to happen in the future? Now, here's one of the more interesting bits about this sutta. "In this, the elder bhikkhus are to be blamed for three reasons. As disciples of the teacher who live secluded, they do not train in seclusion. They are to be blamed for this first reason. They do not abandon what the teacher tells them to abandon. They are to be blamed for this second reason. They are luxurious and careless." Leaders, I'm just struggling here not to say luxurious with a Yorkshire accent here. I'll try to... spare you. Luxurious and careless leaders in backsliding and neglectful of seclusion, they are to be blamed for this third reason. The elder bhikkhus are to be blamed for these three reasons. Now in this, the middle teachers are to be blamed, middle bhikkhus, Majjhima bhikkhus are to be blamed for three reasons. As disciples of the teacher live secluded, they do not train in seclusion. They do not abandon what the teacher tells them to abandon. They are luxurious and careless leaders in backsliding, neglectful of seclusion. And also the new bhikkhus are to be blamed for three reasons. They do not train in seclusion. They do not abandon what the teacher tells them to abandon. They are luxurious and careless leaders in backsliding and neglectful of seclusion. The new bhikkhus are to be blamed for these three reasons. So, of course, these three groups of bhikkhus, the young bhikkhus, usually understood as being up to five reigns, is the young bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. The between five and ten reigns is the Majjhima or middle bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, and over ten vasa is regarded as being an elder bhikkhu or bhikkhuni.
In the context of the luxurious state, like what would the bhikkhus, because you can't earn anything, what would the bhikkhus?
You can't own anything.
Earn.
Own or earn? Did you say own or earn?
Own.
Own.
You know, you have your robes and your bowl.
Oh, you can own stuff.
As personal?
Yeah.
It's mine and you can't...
It's mine. My precious. Yeah, sure, this is a misunderstanding which was actually originally put around in Buddhist circles by Western scholars who were kind of brought up with the kind of the Benedictine monks and their vow of poverty. Not to have, actually personally own anything, whereas in Buddhism there's no similar vow of poverty. You can own, for example, a Harley Davidson.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. I know a bhikkhu who was able to give up everything except for his Harley when he ordained.
There's an abbot in Bangkok's got 42 Mercedes Benzes or something.
Yeah, yeah.
But he says it's okay because he bought it with his own money.
Yeah, yeah. So 42 Mercedes Benzes. Well, that's just a detail. Details.
Might be sad again now.
Well, he said he bought them because he likes them.
So
is there a backsliding going on?
Perhaps, yeah. Perhaps this might be. I wonder if this might be what the Buddha was meaning when he was saying bhikkhus are luxurious and leaders in backsliding. Yeah. And interesting that it kind of starts off with the elder bhikkhus and then goes on to the young bhikkhus. Perhaps sometimes that the elder bhikkhus have much more opportunities to be luxurious and leaders in backsliding. Sometimes maybe the young monks would be thinking to themselves, if only I would have such an opportunity to be luxurious and a leader in backsliding, then I would, but they don't necessarily get the chance. Whereas the elder bhikkhus are the ones who typically get offered much more requisites. And they typically are entrusted with large sums of money, and they often are in situations where their decisions as to what to do with that money and how their priorities and so on are not scrutinized or criticized, and so they feel able to do things like creating various kinds of tasteless and revolting monstrosities in the name of Buddhist architecture. And buying 42 Mercedes Benzes, and I don't know, has anyone got any other good examples to contribute?
Senior monk's kutis.
Senior monk's kutis, yeah.
Special toilets.
Marble ones, special toilets. Stretch limos. Ajahn Pasano was saying when they were in Canada and they visited Venerable Pia Dumbo, they were just staying, they just moved into this place, it's like in the deepest, darkest woods of Canada, and they were just staying literally in just this shack in the woods in Canada. And they were going, Ajahn Pasano and Ajahn Jayasara were going out to visit them just after they'd moved in. And for some reason, the lay follower got them a stretch limo to go out there and stay. So they rolled up in this stretch limo to this kind of backwoods shack.
Did they put a
tape
wheels up for the
box? Yeah, it probably would have been probably bigger than the place I was staying in, so yeah. So there are many examples of this kind of thing. And of course, you know, you have to be sensitive about it in in public. My story of going on business class when I was in Malaysia, and I wanted to go to, staying in Ipoh, I wanted to go to Thailand to renew my visa. And so some people came down from Penang, Dustin and his friends came down from Penang, and they heard that I wanted to go to Thailand. So they said, oh, we'll buy you a plane ticket to go to Bangkok. I was actually going to Bangkok to stay at Ajahn Dhan's monastery. And they said, oh, we'll get you a plane ticket. I said, no, that won't be necessary. I'm very happy. Just like a second or third class train ticket is perfectly adequate. No problems. No, we must get you a plane ticket. No. You must please just get me a train. No. You must get me a plane ticket. No. Please get me just a train ticket. It's fine. No. We must get you a plane ticket. And I said, well, you're buying the ticket, so I just have to leave it up to you. So they went off. Then, finally, when I arrived at Penang to get the plane, then I found out that they hadn't been able to get at all a plane from Penang to Bangkok. They hadn't been able to get at all a plane from KL to Bangkok. And they'd only been able to get a business class ticket from Penang to Singapore, and then another one from another business class ticket from Singapore to Bangkok. And when I first heard that they got business class, I was quite upset with them. I was going to give them a good telling off. But then when I realized what difficulty they'd had in actually getting any kind of ticket at all, and this was the last thing that they got. So anyway, so I get on the business class feeling very embarrassed, and I sit down in my seat and we sort of take off. This was a Thai Airlines. This was the one from Singapore, and sitting in the Thai Airlines, and then this drunken and obnoxious American sort of leans over me and says, oh, well, this is very humble for a monk, isn't it, to be sitting in business class? Don't you think that monks should be more humble than this? And all the top poor old Thai air stewardesses were sort of like, oh my god, what am I going to do? And I just kind of sat there feeling dreadfully embarrassed. And I didn't know whether to answer back to him, in which case maybe we would have got into more of an argument or something, so I just kind of sat there feeling very embarrassed. Anyway, he was soon distracted by chatting up the hostesses, so it was all right. So this is what can happen to those monks who are, sometimes you think monks are luxurious and leaders in backsliding, and maybe sometimes they are, maybe sometimes they're not.
If monks have much money during this time, and then in this time, I mean, now we can talk about Harley Davidson. So how did they manage to be luxurious? Is it that they received gifts from people and just amassed them without redistributing?
Yeah, in some cases, yeah. You know, they could receive gifts of you know, whatever, luxurious kutis, fine requisites, cloths, and things like that. I mean, the things which they were getting in those days, which would have been luxurious, are things which probably today we think is no big deal, you know, like getting lots of robes or something like that. I mean, today it just means nothing because we have, you know, we have machine-woven cloth and it's so much cheaper and easier to get. But in those days, to have large piles of cloth was a real sign of wealth, you know. These are the kinds of things. Yeah.
There's also a linear rule against distributing things that have been dedicated for the Sangha to yourself.
So all of these kinds of restrictions, and I think it's very important that this is one area where we have to in the Vinaya where we have to keep the letter of the Vinaya, but also, you know, even much more important to keep the spirit of the Vinaya than the letter, you know, and really having to look at these things and asking what's really necessary, and constantly testing ourselves. And it's very important to do this, to sort of see, well, what can I live without, and how can I practice contentment with these kinds of things. This is always very important when we're given a dwelling place or something like that, not to be complaining about it. If someone asks us to live in such and such a kuti, we don't complain about it or make a fuss or anything like that. We don't get elated when we get a good kuti and disappointed when we get a bad kuti. Just go wherever we're asked to go and just stay there. Same with robes and all of these kinds of things, just to be very content with them. And it is interesting that the same training, you know, for the young bhikkhus, middle bhikkhus and the senior bhikkhus, there's certainly no excuse given to the senior bhikkhus for kind of backsliding, being luxurious, any more than anybody else. And in fact, if anything, it looks like that's maybe being more emphasized. Okay, so then Sariputta gives the positive side, the positive spin. In what ways? Friends? Do disciples of the teacher who lives secluded train in seclusion? Here, disciples of the teacher who lives secluded train in seclusion. They abandon what the teacher tells them to abandon. They are not luxurious and careless. They are keen to avoid backsliding and are leaders in seclusion. In this, the elder bhikkhus are to be commended for three reasons, the middle bhikkhus are to be commended for three reasons, and the new bhikkhus are to be commended for three reasons. They abandon, as disciples of a teacher who lives secluded, they live in seclusion. They abandon what the teacher tells them to abandon, and they are not luxurious and careless. They are keen to avoid backsliding, and they are leaders in seclusion. They are to be commended for these three reasons. Okay? So then, Sariputta goes on to talk about a list of various kinds of defilements. Now, according to the note here, which is probably derived from the commentary in Bhikkhu Bodhi, the evil qualities mentioned here, the various kinds of defilements, and in the sections that follow, are introduced to show the states referred to above in section 6 by the statement, they do not abandon what the teacher tells them to abandon. They are also the factors that induce a bhikkhu to become an heir of material things rather than an heir of dhamma. In Majjhima Nikaya 7.3, which we'll read in a few weeks, the Vatthupama Sutta, the same 16 qualities with ill will substituted for hate are referred to as the imperfections that defile the mind, citta-supa-kilesa. So the list of dhammas introduced here, the first couple of dhammas, greed and hate, lobha and dosa. Then the next one is anger and revenge, which are godha and upanaha. The next one, contempt and a domineering attitude, makko cha palaso, domineering attitude. So this is different kinds of conceit or arrogance. The one has this domineering attitude, always thinking that you're right and trying to push your point of view over on top of others. Envy and avarice, isa and avarice machera. Deceit and fraud, maya cha satheya. Obstinacy, tambho, like stiffness or rigidness, and presumption, sarambho. Vanity and negligence, mano, or usually translated as conceit. Conceit and atimano, arrogance. Atimano being an intensification of conceit. Madocha, pamadocha is vanity and negligence. So in all of these cases, all of these pairs of akusala dhammas, unwholesome dhammas, there is a middle way for the abandoning of all of these dhammas, giving vision, giving knowledge which leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. And what is that middle way? It is just this noble eightfold path. That is to say, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right samadhi. This is the middle way, giving vision, giving knowledge which leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. Now this kind of list of akusala dhammas, unwholesome tendencies of the mind, we'll find this kind of thing repeated a few times in the next several suttas, like the Anangana Sutta, the Saleka Sutta, and so on. And so it's a bit of a theme of this first chapter, the Majjhima Nikaya. And interesting to see how each one is put in opposition here to the middle way. And when Sariputta mentions this, of course, he's actually quoting from the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. Okay, so the exact phrase that he's using here is found in the identical form in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. So he, as the disciple, is quoting from his teacher's words. For those of you who've read the first part of my History of Mindfulness, I talk about the difference between sutta and vyakarana, where a sutta is like a pithy doctrinal statement. Okay, so for example, the statement, be my heirs in material things, not my heirs in the dhammas, this would be a sutta in that kind of sense. Or this statement on the middle way, there is this middle way for leading to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. What is that middle way? Just this noble eightfold path, that is right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right samadhi. So this is sutta, which is spoken by the Buddha. Now here this sutta is being taken and quoted by a disciple. Okay, and so he's actually just cutting and pasting it, just quoting directly this sutta. And notice that this is done in a interrogation context. So he started out by discussing it with the other bhikkhus. He's not simply declaring these things, but he's there's like a question and answer format that we've been introduced to the whole thing through. So this kind of question and answer format is called a vyakarana. And so this discourse as a whole is a vyakarana discourse. It's a discourse in a question and answer format which takes up those central or those basic doctrinal statements, which are the sutta, and then expounds them, explains them, and gives them more details, puts them in other contexts, and so on and so forth. So this is how I understand these two terms to refer to these two very important types of early discourse. And so the sutta, in that very narrow sense, the sutta is actually much narrower. That doesn't just mean all the discourses, it means just one small section of the discourses, and primarily those discourses found in the Samyutta Nikaya. So this is my understanding of those terms.
Sorry, could you... So, I didn't quite get it. So, are you saying that sutta is like the pithy instruction within the sutta, right?
Right. So we have to stop. Okay. So we have to stop using sutta to mean the discourse as a whole.
Okay.
Right. So I think that that's a later usage.
Okay. And what do you use for discourses as a whole? Discourses as a whole.
Something like that. Yeah.
Okay. And sutta is the pithy instruction in discourses.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's how sutta. Usually, that's what it usually means in Indian literature as a whole. Like in, say, the Yoga Sutra, the Yoga Sutra is sometimes translated as aphorisms. So the aphorisms on yoga, and it's actually like a series of things. So the first one, it says, yoga is a cessation of the vacillations of the mind. That's the first sutra in the Yoga Sutra, and then of course the commentary then gives all the explanation for that. And similarly, for example, in the Padimokkha, in the Vinaya, has a list of 227 rules for bhikkhus, and the rules themselves are very pithy. They just give a pithy summary, yeah, and then sometimes maybe just one word. It might be just one word that the actual rule is summarized. Sampajanam sarvadeva pachitiyang. False speech and full awareness is a pachitya. So, and then of course there's a whole background story, analysis, description and so on, which is there. So the sutta, again, is that pithy kind of thing which is memorized, and then the rest of it is the background to that. Yeah. Yeah. And the significance of this is that in the discourses themselves, that they refer to a system of organizing the Buddha's teachings called the nine angas. Nine sections of the teaching, and in those nine angas, the first three are sutta, gaya, and vyakarana. Gaya meaning verse or prose and verse, and so we have sutta and vyakarana. And I think that's what these terms sutta and vyakarana mean in this context, because obviously sutta is just one of the nine sections. It's not all of the nine. Yeah, so it's one of those nine sections, and there I think this is what it means. It means those basic statements given by the Buddha himself. Yeah. So sutta is specifically given by the Buddha, whereas vyakarana, like we have here, can be either by the Buddha or by disciples. Yeah, that's very common. Yeah, and in the Padimokkha itself, it refers to itself as the sutta. This rule, this Dhamma, comes up for recitation in the Sutta, and is recited in the Sutta every fortnight. So this actually is what it says in the Padimokkha itself.
So you think then that's and you're saying that's the Sutta because they're all pithy instructions, it's all pithy in there.
Yeah. So they're the characteristics of what I would call a Sutta. Is one, it's pithy. Two, it's spoken by the Buddha, it's prose, yeah, and it's directly dealing with or addressing a sort of central point of the Dhamma and Vinaya. This is really what a sutta is about. Yeah, whereas the Vyakarana is like explaining, elaborating, and giving examples, giving background, and all of these kinds of things. So this is what the Venerable Sariputta said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Venerable Sariputta's words. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So this is the Dhammadayada Sutta, much simpler than some of the other ones we've looked at. Very practical, as it seems, as I mentioned before, likely that it was given in a particular context where the Buddha was giving kind of a bit of an admonishment. When we see the Buddha teaching in quite a strong way like this, often that it's an admonishment to the bhikkhus. And the three versions, Pali and the two Chinese versions, extremely similar, very close, only a few minor differences between them. Okay, so any more questions on that sutta? Or, I can't say sutta anymore. Yeah.
I think maybe something comes to mind for me. I mean, this, in this context, Bodhisattvas can be referring to physical seclusion. Well, i.e., going in a hut in the forest.
Right, exactly, like. Yeah.
But something, if I recall, I think you may have said at last rains, taught on mental seclusion in the sense that, well, when you go back to your kuti, go back alone mentally, you know, something has happened throughout the day or whatever,
yeah.
You know, don't actually carry that in your mind back to your kuti. So for me, whilst physical seclusion is obviously what's being addressed here, also for me, that being honest, you know, are you abiding with mental seclusion as well, or are you allowing a whole lot of garbage just to go over and over and over and
so. Yeah, you can take a whole host of individuals back with you to your kuti. It's amazing.
Turn up, didn't
take that with you. Maybe you have like five people in the house or something like that, but then when they go back to their huts, each of them takes all of them back to their huts, so you actually go from having five to having like 25, because everyone's got the five there. Yeah.
Then go back to your kuti alone. Referring to mental seclusion.
Yeah.
Often recall that to my own mind when there's been more than one person.
Yeah. It is, and that's really one of the great things about living in a forest monastery like this. We actually have that physical opportunity when you're walking there, and this is one of the things I love so much. You've got a house, things are going on, your people, staff, blah blah blah, and you walk and you just walk along a forest path for 10 minutes or 20 minutes, and that gives you the time to just drop stuff, and you just concentrate on your movements, your postures, looking at the bush. Walking along peacefully and being mindful, and then this gives you the chance to just drop that, and then to always just try to rejoice when you get back to your kuti. It's just so lovely to get back there and have a nice peaceful, clean place you can sit meditation and no problems. So this is that's one of the great things about. I've always found it much more difficult if you're staying in a place, where maybe you're just sort of living in a Dhamma center or something in the city, and then you have to. When I was living in Penang for a few months in the peace house, and it was a very nice place. It's kind of quiet enough and so on. It's not like there was great noises or anything, but you're just sort of there, and all the stuff is there as well. And so when you go back, it's just, well, I'll just go into my room and stuff, and it's just not the same. So we're extremely privileged to have this chance to live in the forest and in his forest monks.
So the Buddha gives that other one in the Samyutta Nikaya about gains and loss? About the. So reviling and so.
So dreadful. Yeah.
It says that a good mother would instruct her daughter, saying, if you become a nun, do not let gains and loss come upon you.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's, very, very hard to find, people really practicing this. Just talking with Ajahn Brahm today, he's saying, because when they go to this conference in Japan, they go to this World Buddhist Summit, and the organizers of this extremely wealthy Buddhist group in Japan, and I think they're sponsored by the big construction companies or something in Japan, and they've their kind of Dhamma center is about like a 1 square kilometer of sort of buildings, you know, high-rise, luxurious, marble-coated buildings with a
fake forest, isn't it?
Yeah, well, there was a mountain obstructing the view, so they took it away. And somebody said that it was difficult for older people to get from the entrance gate to the hall, because it's like 2 kilometers or something from the entrance gate to the hall. So they put in their underground railway to take them. And so on and so forth. But when they go there, they invite delegates from each country. So they invite they usually invite one individual, and then that individual has to invite a few other people from the country. And when they go, they all get given a substantial sum of money, maybe like 1 million yen or something like that for each person. And when Ajahn Brahm's invited, he always makes a point to invite somebody from each tradition, so they make sure they have Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana representatives, and that they have lay representatives, and that they have both men and women represented, and that the money that's offered is split equally among all of them. So nobody is not that he, because he was the one who was first invited as the leader, and so he doesn't sort of take any extra or anything. They just divide it up equally, and in fact, from now on, they're actually going to divide it up among the Federation of Australian Buddhist Councils and the ASA, so that it's not actually taken by any individuals, except for expenses. And he said that almost all the other countries, that the people who are invited just bring along some of their own followers. They don't actually bring people, they don't bring representatives to cover Buddhism in their country. They just bring along a few of their own followers, and then they just keep the money for their own temple. So in a sense, it's kind of, it's understandable that people want to have money to develop their temple and so on. But you do see that difference in orientation of people, like what are they actually trying to build? Are you just building your own temple, your own followers, or are you really trying to build the Dhamma in your country? And so that's a very good example.
I think that's also been true of the lay centers in the United States.
Uh-huh.
Like, I mean, Spirit Rock is really beautiful, which is the biggest lay center, teaching center, and retreat center on the West Coast. And sometimes it's painful to go there because it's so exquisite and beautiful that I think, wow, we could have done 3 centers, the ordinary, it's not so beautiful, but in places that don't have any centers at all. Because California is a state with a lot of money, and there are places like South Dakota, for example, that don't have very much money and would never be able to afford that kind of center, so I think it's...
Yeah, it's always a problem, isn't it? Yeah.
On the other hand, it's so nice to practice, the plus is it's so nice to practice in such a lovely place.
Yeah.
Such a pleasure.
Yeah.
The rooms are nice, and they're clean, and they're carpeted, and every room has a base, their own basin with hot water and a little cupboard. I mean, your own room, nice bed and underfloor heating.
Yeah. It's one of those things. I don't think there is any one right answer, and I don't think there's any, in those kinds of cases, you can't say, well, one thing's right or one thing's wrong, But I certainly think in some cases, it just goes over the top, and we use it as an excuse. Doing things that are just not useful at all. But then I think we have to just try to do our best in a particular situation.
I think some of it is about class, that if you come from a middle class or upper middle class background, there's this sort of expected assumption that receiving money and then creating something around comfort, that it's sort of like not practicing and not always holding the reality of the whole world and suffering the whole world. Which I think, when you're conditioned around class, that's what happens. So that if the group of people who are organizing a temple, organizing a retreat center, happen to come from, let's say, middle class background, and you're not actively investigating that, then I think you can make those, what you're saying is, oh, I'm doing the best I can, and I think they are, but there isn't that attention, you know, that awareness and that attention to those issues.
Is that a class thing, or is that, does everyone think if they get money that they're going to try to make something comfortable? I think most working class people would do the same thing if they could.
And I think every place would attract what is needed. You know, I often think about myself that I find it hard enough to meditate. To go to the what and meditate is too much of a challenge to me. You know, so, but other people love it. You know, for me to go to Blackheath, where I get my own room, my own bathroom, great, all I have to think about is meditating. I don't have to worry about it. Yeah. So I think everything is right in its right place, as it happens. Because people change all the time with going to places, don't they? It's never the same people all the time.
But yeah, I do think that they certainly think that there's you know, some truth, and I think that we get blind, and I think that, you know, something I noticed, as I think I mentioned before, that, you know, when I went to Thailand and places, and, you know, you can see there's a difference, and certainly in India as well, the difference in the monasteries, and the monks living like princes in some of these monasteries, you know, there's huge marble salas with these overstuffed luxurious couches at one end, and, you know, all this delicious food coming up, and, you know, here it's just like a prince you're living, and, you know, all the villagers you see are just living in such very, very bad circumstances. And similar in Thailand, that you know, you see that the monks, not infrequently in the forest monasteries, are living in a much more luxurious way than the villagers who are supporting them. But, you know, I mean, it's not in every way. I mean, the villagers, of course, they have their TVs and they have their fridges and they have all of these kinds of things. So they have some things that the monks don't have. But in terms of just the niceness of their dwelling place, and having a clean, well-built, attractive dwelling place with space around it and all of these kinds of things, certainly the monks often living very, very luxuriously. So not such a problem in this monastery.
Mm-hmm.
Luxurious caves that the monks are living in. So I do take that care to, you know, when we're building the kutis and things like that, to keep them very, very simple. And, you know, it's always possible to say, well, we could do a little bit extra XYZ, and you could put a veranda there, or you could do a little bit of something, 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 and a little bit of this and that, and make it much nicer. And of course you can do those things, and it makes it much nicer, but the cost goes up quite quickly. And, you know, I always ask myself, what actually do you need from a kuti? You know, you need a place that's clean, you need a place that's reasonably protected from the weather, and that it's good enough for you to meditate in. That's what you actually need. So just to make sure that those things are looked after, and, not so much worrying about what people actually want.
There's a story in the Desert Fathers of, there's a monk criticizing, or a recluse criticizing another recluse for having a servant.
Mm.
He was only living in a little cell once, he was a famous recluse, and he said, you know, how can you have a servant? And he said, well, how did you live before? And he said, well, I was a shepherd, and I used to sleep outside, and I barely had enough to eat. And he said, well, how do you live now? Do you live better than you did before? And he said, oh, yeah, I live much better than I did before.
Mm-hmm.
I got a place to stay, and I got food. And,
mm-hmm.
and he said, well, before I was a senator in Rome, and I used to sleep on a bed made out of solid gold, and I had luxurious silk sheets, and hundreds of servants, and I had the best food possible. And he said, for me, I'm doing a greater renunciation than you are, because you're actually living more luxuriously than you did in the past.
Agreed
with him. He stopped criticizing him.
Yeah. Well, that was like me, as I was a kind of a bum and a hobo before I became a monk. I used to live on the sleeve in the parks and stuff. I used to do that all the time. And just go busking, earn enough money to buy a falafel roll and a cappuccino. Well, no, and a falafel roll and an espresso. And when I went to Thailand, it was always catch a third class train. I'd never think of catching anything else if travelling around Thailand, you know, just get on the place. It's extremely uncomfortable a lot of the time, but I just couldn't afford the second class train. And it's just how I lived. It's all right. It's good. You know, you get to learn a lot of things that you wouldn't learn. You see a lot of people you wouldn't see otherwise. So now I get to go business class.
Yeah, well, it's like people say, you know, they complain in Australia that they're living below the poverty line, and then you see what they're below the poverty line is. They have a car or two cars, you know, and they have one TV or two TVs, and they've got everything that they need.
Mm.
And then compared to someone middle class in, Cambodia or India, they might be actually living at the same level as they are.
Mm.
And someone who would be considered below the poverty line have almost nothing. Mm. And they'd be more content than the people living in
below
the poverty line.
Yeah, it's a lot to do with inequality, I think, is the two things. One is the absolute level of your wealth, and the other one is what is your wealth compared with what people around you have. And that's actually what causes a lot more suffering.
It's like housing complexes that they've built in Australia and in Europe to put the poor, and then they end up as breeding grounds for crime and drugs, and they blame the building complex.
Mm.
But those building complexes are much, much more luxurious, and the flats are much bigger, maybe three times, four times what people live in Hong Kong.
Mm.
And they don't have the same problems as they do in Hong Kong.
Mm.
So it's got nothing to do with the building complex.
Mm.
It's just the people's attitude to live in them.
Mm.
I also think it's the cultural weight of what it means to live in one of those places. You know, it's not sort of value neutral. It's that there's a lot of... When you live in a place like that, the way people relate to you from government agencies to everything else is so laden with often disrespect and negativity. You know, that I just think that's also something to include in
it's all your intentions.
The picture.
Mm. Yeah. Well, yeah, that comes back to the whole, you know, equality or inequality thing. It's very, very powerful. Okay, so let's finish up with some respects.
Bhagavato